From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. calls for a transparent investigation of a Russian murder. A Netanyahu speech before the U.S. Congress raises tensions with Obama. It's almost a year since Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 went missing. And a warning against overexposure to social media.
The problem is when technology and social media become the master and we become tethered to our devices.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has called for a thorough and transparent investigation into the murder of Russian opposition politician and activist Boris Nemtsov. VOA's Victor Beatty reports former Russian chess champion and rights activist Garry Kasparov says he is shattered by the news of the death and says it comes amid an atmosphere of propaganda and hatred aimed at opponents of President Vladimir Putin.
Appearing on the ABC Network program this week Sunday, Secretary Kerry says the U.S. has no intelligence on who might be responsible for the late Friday murder of Nemtsov, who was gunned down on a Moscow street near the Kremlin.
We hope there will be a thorough, transparent, real investigation, not just of who actually fired the shots, but who, if anyone, may have ordered or instructed this or been behind this.
Kerry described Nemtsov as deeply committed to a better relationship between Russia and the rest of the world.
As Deputy Prime Minister, he worked hard to improve the relationship with the United States. He was known as an activist, as engaged and engaging. And we are enormously saddened to hear of his murder. And we hope the authorities will join the world in producing the credible, transparent investigation necessary to find out who was behind this and who did it.
President Barack Obama, in a statement Friday, called Nemtsov a tireless advocate for his country, seeking for his fellow Russian citizens the rights to which all people are entitled. Mr. Obama expressed admiration for Nemtsov's courageous dedication to the struggle against corruption in Russia. Appearing on the NBC program Meet the Press Sunday, former world chess champion and chairman of the New York-based Human Rights Foundation, Garry Kasparov, calls the murder of Nemtsov, a man he knew for more than 20 years and collaborated with since 2004 to oppose Mr. Putin, another crime in Putin's Russia. Mr. Putin has vowed to pursue those who killed Nemtsov. Kasparov was asked if Mr. Putin was behind the murder.
Whether he gave a direct order, I don't know. Probably we'll never know. But definitely the atmosphere in the country was 24/7 propaganda of hatred, where people who disagreed with Putin have been portrayed as national traitors, the fifth columnist, enemies of the state, and Boris was one of the most formidable critics of Putin's regime.
Kasparov, writing Sunday in the Wall Street Journal, says the question of whether Mr. Putin gave the order to kill Nemtsov rings as hollow today as when journalist Anna Politkovskaya was gunned down in 2006, the same year that Putin critic Alexander Litvinenko was poisoned in London, or when a Malaysia Airlines passenger jet was shot down over eastern Ukraine last year. Kasparov says many Russian opposition leaders are either behind bars or out of the country.
And now, with Boris, probably one of the bravest of us, and the man who was standing tall, criticizing Putin, and by the way, he was preparing his new report on Russian troops in Ukraine just to prove another Kremlin's lie, right. Him being killed, and not just killed in a dark corner of the city, but just in front of Kremlin. It sends chilling signal to everybody. It spreads fear and terror. So that's why I expect the regime will benefit from this murder.
Kasparov says no one in Moscow who opposes the Putin government feels safe. As for a U.S. reaction, he says, don't treat Mr. Putin as just another democratic leader.
Stop making deals and stop trying to bring Putin to the negotiating table, because his agenda is totally opposite to the agenda of the United States or Europe. Putin wants to destroy Ukrainian statehood. Putin wants crisis, because crisis, wars, the lack of international security, those are elements that are absolutely vital for his survival in Russia.
Kasparov says the best way to remember Boris Nemtsov is to arm Ukraine in its fight against Russian-backed separatists. Former Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Kazyanov says he believes the murder will make change in Russia unavoidable. But Russia analyst Jonathan Adelman of the University of Denver disagrees.
Putin is over 80% popularity in Russia today. The opposition, which several years ago seemed to have some chance to overthrow him, kind of fizzled away. Putin is also doing very well in Ukraine. Unfortunately, the strength of the opposition is mainly limited to Moscow and to St. Petersburg. But in the other 80-85% of the country, Putin is still very popular. So Boris Nemtsov was an important leader. He was deputy prime minister. He was supposed to be the one who likely would replace Boris Yeltsin at the end of the 90s. But sadly, the cause that which we believe in and he believed in still has a long way to go, I'm afraid, in Russia.
Edelman says the Russian opposition is receiving very little support from the West. Further evidence the world has left the post-Cold War period and entered what he calls a new, more authoritarian period. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is preparing to deliver a controversial speech before a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress. The address, coming 2 weeks before elections in which Mr. Netanyahu is seeking a fourth term, has heightened tensions between the two traditional partners. VOA's Scott Bob has details from Jerusalem.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he must address the joint meeting of the U.S. Congress, despite criticism at home and abroad that it is causing a serious rift in U.S.-Israeli relations. The U.S. and five European powers are in tough negotiations with Iran over a deal that reportedly would suspend Iran's nuclear weapons program in exchange for the lifting of sanctions against it. Mr. Netanyahu said Sunday that his trip is a crucial, even historical mission, and he is going as the messenger of all Israelis, even those who do not agree with him.
I feel the concern and sincere for the safety of all Israelis, for the country.
He says he feels a deep and sincere concern for the security of all Israelis and the fate of the country, and says he will do all in his power to secure their future. The prime minister earlier said it appears that U.S. and European powers have accepted a gradual easing of restrictions on Iran's nuclear program that within a few years could allow Tehran to make a nuclear weapon. He says he cannot accept this. Many U.S. politicians say the negotiations concede too much to the Iranian government, which advocates the destruction of Israel and, they say, backs terrorism around the world. The Obama administration opposes the speech, saying it comes during the Israeli electoral campaign and could be seen as U.S. meddling in Israeli politics. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told the Congress last week that criticism of the negotiations was premature.
The policy is Iran will not get a nuclear weapon. And anybody running around right now jumping in to say, well, we don't like the deal or this or that, doesn't know what the deal is. There is no deal yet. And I caution people to wait and see what these negotiations produce.
National Security Advisor Susan Rice said that Mr. Netanyahu's insistence on speaking at this time has injected a degree of partisanship that she thinks is destructive to the fabric of the relationship. Israeli political analyst Akiva Eldar called the speech a political ploy.
I believe that Netanyahu knows what we know, that this talk is not going to change the American policy in regard to Iran's nuclear program, but it will definitely not improve the relationship with the President of the United States.
He believes the speech is aimed at drawing votes from Israel's right wing. On the streets of Jerusalem, opinions were as divided as among the politicians. Anthony Simon said Mr. Netanyahu should be allowed to speak.
I believe that America is a country that's for freedom of speech, so I think the Prime Minister has a right to say what he wants to say, like everybody else has a right to say what they want to say.
Shop owner Mati Simantov said the speech should have been postponed.
I think it's not good for us with the relationship with the United States. I think we have to keep to be in good condition with the United States. Our friend, only friend probably in the world. So we have to be very gentle with them. I think Bibi doesn't do that. I think he's disrespect them. I don't like it.
Jerusalemite Malka Shemtov said she does not believe the speech will change opinions one way or the other. She says voters believe that the prime minister is using the speech for his benefit, as he believes it will bring him more votes. But this is not going to help, she says. It's not going to affect the vote. Many agree that Mr. Netanyahu's speech will not enhance his standing among the opposition, but they say his tough stance against the Obama administration could help him with security-minded voters. Scott Bob, VOA News, Jerusalem.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Australian Deputy Prime Minister Warren Tuss says the search for missing Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, one of aviation history's biggest mysteries, cannot go on forever. However, Tuss told the Reuters news agency Australia, Malaysia, and China, spearheading the search, want to do everything that's reasonable possible to locate the aircraft. The Boeing 777, with 239 people on board, mostly Malaysian and Chinese, vanished while en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing on March 8, 2014. Since the end of June, the international search has focused on an area of about 60,000 square kilometers of the southern Indian Ocean west of Australia. Malaysian analyst James Chin of the University of Tasmania in Australia tells VOA's Victor Beattie, if the search is called off, it will only fuel a series of conspiracy theories about what may have happened.
If they do not find the aircraft, I think a lot of people will come to believe the various conspiracy theories about what happened to the aircraft. They really do need to find the aircraft in order for the family to have closure and perhaps more importantly, to bring confidence back into flying.
Do you think the aircraft or debris will ever be found?
If you had asked me that question last year, I would have said yes, but now I'm not so sure. It looks very likely that maybe all the experts are wrong and that the aircraft is actually not somewhere in the South Indian Ocean. It could really be anywhere around the world. The latest conspiracy theory is that the aircraft is actually in Kazakhstan in Central Asia. So that's the latest theory. But again, if you look through all the writings that was published on this incident last year, basically you got people saying that the aircraft is located in Kazakhstan in the Middle East. Some even were suggesting that the aircraft was actually located at a U.S. military base in Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. So it's all over the place.
What actually led investigators to look in the southern Indian Ocean? Was there any evidence to suggest the plane went down there?
The data to locate the plane actually came from a London-based organization that sold the tracking system to Malaysian Airlines. So basically, they passed the data on to Malaysian Airlines, and Malaysian Airlines used a couple of consultants to try to map out the route taken. And the general consensus at that time among the experts was that it is most likely that the aircraft was in the south of the Indian Ocean, closest to the Australian landmass.
The investigation is being headed up by Australia, China, and Malaysia. Are they conferring as to whether to proceed?
Probably there will be some sort of discussion, but really the issue is finance. I think, if I'm not mistaken, they've spent close to $200 million just on the search operation in the South Indian Ocean. So I suppose when it comes from the cost perspective, you really can't justify looking for the aircraft forever.
What's the impact on the families of the passengers on board and the future of Malaysian Airlines?
I think the families need to see the actual body or the actual aircraft in order to have some closure. The latest news is that a group of the families from the Chinese passengers, they have actually gone from China to Malaysia, and they're going to hold some sort of demonstration in Kuala Lumpur during the anniversary that's coming up. And they're going to try to pressure the Malaysian government and, I suppose, the Chinese government to double the efforts to find the aircraft.
In late January, the Malaysian government officially called the disappearance of Flight 370 an accident, allowing families of the passengers and crew to receive compensation from the airline and insurers. Meanwhile, the Malaysian government will reportedly release a statement on the status of the search effort on or about the March 8th anniversary. Sierra Leone's vice president has put himself in quarantine for 21 days after one of his bodyguards died of Ebola. Sam Sumana becomes the highest-ranking African official to be in quarantine. His decision comes as the West African country reimposes travel restrictions amid a rise in the new cases of the deadly virus. The country recorded 18 new cases of Ebola in the week ending Saturday, reversing a recent decline. More than 9,500 people have died of Ebola since the outbreak began a year ago. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf met with President Obama at the White House Friday. She says while Ebola cases in her country are on the decline, the crisis has not yet passed.
Even though 13 of our 15 political subdivisions have now, you know, had zero new cases, and even though we feel confident that we're getting to the place where we can really say we can confront and we can beat this disease, but we know we're not there yet. We're not there because we are still in a region where there are a few others affected countries, two others. They have not reached the level of success and progress that we have, but we know that we all remain under threat until all of us have reached a place where we get to zero.
She thanked the U.S. military for their role in building treatment facilities to treat Ebola patients. Some believe that children should become computer savvy as soon as possible, but others caution against too much computer experience. We asked John Horvat, President, Vice President of the organization Tradition, Family, and Property, why is it a good thing to limit a child's exposure to high-tech gadgetry?
There's nothing wrong with technology as such. Technology is meant to serve man, to make life easier for men. The problem is when technology and social media become the master and we become tethered to our devices. A lot of what's happening is called, you know, I'm sure people have heard of internet addiction, where it just becomes so addictive that it consumes the lives of especially of children.
What should they be doing instead?
Well, that's a good question, because I think that a child should develop his imagination. And what happens in the case of a lot of this social media is that the person takes on a passive role. And the machine mediates the reality. You know, the Facebook page becomes one's life. You know, you have to impress people with what you put up, whereas what is actually there is doesn't correspond to what's on the screen.
So social media can interfere with a child's social ability.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have cases of children who are unable to communicate correctly because they're so used to text messaging, or even children who aren't able to use their motor motions of their hands, you know, using building blocks, and they're so used to just texting and using their machines.
And there's actually some people who are in the computer industry that limit their children's use.
Right. I mean, the real shocker for me was Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs introduced the computer to just about everywhere, and yet he limited his children to what they could do. They didn't have iPads or iPods.
Now, you've written a book, Return to Order, which stresses the importance of the human element. Why is it so important for the future for us to have the human element?
Right, because the human element is what makes life human, that keeps our life from being very brutal. Sometimes technology can be extremely brutal and just, you know, put pre-made solutions and take out the element of the human element, which makes life much, 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 much better. I say in Return to Order, I say how organic solutions where you adapt to the circumstances and you're not just limited to just some pre-packaged options.
Let's stress it again for our audience that you're not saying no, no, no to social media. You're saying all things in moderation.
Right. I'm saying that you need to really look at what it's doing to you to see if you're having technology serve you. That's what it's made for. If on the other hand, you are serving technology, there are some problems.
I've seen some examples of what you're talking about. I've gone to a family wedding, and the young people all sit together like they usually do. And usually they're laughing and joking and that sort of whispering and giggling. But last time I was going to a wedding, I saw them all sitting there, and they were all doing their social media thing. Nobody was talking, nobody laughing, nobody exchanging. It was kind of sad.
Right. I mean, you go to an airport every time, you know. It's just sometimes I think I'm the only one that's not on a device.
Especially at meals. You go to a restaurant, and everybody at the table is playing with their iPad, and nobody's discussing anything, not even the menu.
Right. I mean, there you have it. You have a case where technology is not really serving. It has that addictive aspect that takes away a very important part of reality.
John Horvat, Vice President of the organization Tradition, Family, and Property, and author of Return to Order. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On March 2nd, 1836, the Republic of Texas declared its independence from Mexico. That date also was the 43rd birthday of Sam Houston, who was the first president of Texas. In 1882, Queen Victoria narrowly escaped an assassination attempt. On this day in 1901, the United States Congress passed the Platt Amendment. That limited the autonomy of Cuba as a condition for the withdrawal of American troops from the island. The man who was perhaps the 20th century's most famous author for children was born on this day in 1904. Theodore Geisel introduced us to such famous characters as the Cat in the Hat and the Grinch who stole Christmas. We better remember Theodore Geisel by his pen name, Dr. Seuss. In 1917, the Russian Revolution was set into motion with the abdication of the last Tsar, Nicholas II. On this day in 1933, the classic movie about the giant ape known as King Kong had its premiere in New York City. In 1946, Ho Chi Minh was elected president of Vietnam. In 1956, Morocco gained its independence from France. In 1959, Miles Davis held the first of two recording sessions that resulted in the album Kind of Blue. In 1962, an army led by General Ne Win seized power in Burma. Also on this day in 1962, Philadelphia Warriors center Wilt Chamberlain scored 100 points in a basketball game against the New York Knicks. That game was played in Hershey, Pennsylvania, where only 4,000 turned out to see the greatest individual scoring performance in NBA history. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Long torn by clan rivalries, stricken by drought and resulting famine, and attacks by a militant extremist group, the East African nation of Somalia has made important strides since completing its political transition in 2012. In a nation once synonymous with chaos, there are hopeful signs of improved security and economic growth. Throughout the process, the United States has stood with the Somali people, providing security, governance, and humanitarian assistance to help strengthen democratic institutions and improve stability. Recognizing Somalia's progress, and as a sign of our nation's deepening relationship with Somalia, President Barack Obama has nominated Catherine S. Denani, a veteran diplomat, as U.S. ambassador to Somalia. It's a critical step towards normalizing the U.S.-Somalia bilateral relationship since our recognition of the federal government of Somalia in January 2013. Since our embassy closed in 1991 amid the country's then-growing instability, the United States conducted diplomacy on Somalia affairs based out of Nairobi. Over the past 5 years, the United States began to travel more frequently into Somalia to conduct official business. When security conditions permit, it is envisioned that an embassy will be reestablished in Mogadishu. While Somalia has come far in the last 2 years, many challenges and threats remain. The Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists Al-Shabaab have been weakened, but not defeated. Government services are uneven, and tens of thousands of Somalis remain displaced from their homes by violence. To keep making progress, the pivotal task for Somalia will not be securing more aid from the United States and other international partners, but for its leaders to put their loyalties and differences behind them and commit to working together for the common good.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.